Hey, before we get started, I just wanted to take a moment and thank all of our Patreon members. You're the people who have made this episode possible and make all our episodes possible. And we want to especially thank our $100 a month Dear Leaders Court members, Ed Brehab, Craig DaCosta, Christy Avery, Jason Doolittle, Jeff Bennett, and Matthew Durbin. Thank you all so much for being partners with us, and thank you so much for supporting We Are Libertarians. If you want to become a patron, if you want to become a Patreon member, then just go to patreon.com/wearelibertarians or find the link in our website, wearelibertarians.com. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Find more great shows like this at wearelibertarians.com. Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Chris Spangle. It is great to have all of you here today. This is another episode of The Swamp Explained, and this is a series where Rob Cortell and I are joined together to talk about the swamp and how Washington works. Rob's a 45-year fly on the wall in Washington, D.C., and Rob has worked for Republican presidential campaigns, government agencies like the EPA, and has been confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission. He's also been a candidate for Congress and Senate, and given his experience and iconoclastic viewpoints, Rob gives us a great insight into the swamp that makes up our nation's capital. Joining me now is Rob Cortell from, where are you at now?
I'm on Gwen's Island in Matthews County today.
Okay.
In a gorgeous day down on the water, and you're looking at me, you can see that I am about half blinded by the light off of the water here.
Yeah, it's been beautiful and sunny here. And so when it's 46 degrees in the Midwest in the springtime, everybody goes out. I was wearing shorts yesterday. I will not put on Lake Prisons today. It's when it's nice out, we're all, nope, it's spring now. So
that's right.
Yeah. So lots to talk about. I think we should start with the presidential race. I can't think of, now obviously my memory of politics really only kind of goes back to 92. You know, Joe Biden basically was dead and 96 hours later was the front runner. And I can't think of a time where anybody kind of had a Lazarus-like resurrection in modern politics. I mean, is there any parallel to Joe Biden's complete destruction turned front runner, I'm going to be the nominee status?
You know, I think they're probably, the one that comes to my mind immediately, of course, is George H.W. Bush after he was running, when he was running for president, after when he was vice president. And I think, I can't remember, but there were a stack of candidates against him. And we, you know, I think Pat, what's his name?
Buchanan.
Came at him from the right, and South Carolina was our firewall then, and South Carolina has been a firewall, I think, both to Democrats and Republicans. Frankly, it doesn't surprise me, and it's much more traditional. It's a better representation, frankly, of the body politic than either New Hampshire or Iowa. So I think a lot of candidates kind of get that. But this is where this really is a media circus and a contest and everything else. You know, if there were no ups and downs, Chris, we wouldn't have a thing to talk about.
No, exactly right. So there's always something interesting happening. Why?
Well, and if there's not anything interesting happening, we're going to make something up.
That's exactly right. Fake news. No, we'd talk about my new haircut.
Yeah, right. I like your haircut.
Thank you. So why is South Carolina, it's always termed the firewall for some candidate. Rudy Giuliani in 2008, George Bush in 88, Joe Biden in 2020. Is it because Iowa and New Hampshire, talking like I'm from New Hampshire, and Nevada has snuck itself in there, but I mean, it's a caucus state. So is it because it's the first real contest?
It's the first real contest where people actually go out and have to pull a lever or some equivalent. You know, Iowa is lily white. Vermont is lily white. Nevada, I noticed Harry Reid was claiming was the first real show of a broad demographic, which I suppose is technically true, but you know, Nevada is not a real state.
It's like 85% federal land.
Yeah, right. And you know what they say, what happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. And I'd say that's about as much influence as Nevada has on it too. But so South Carolina is the biggest of the first round of actual state voting. And, you know, Biden actually did really well across the board. We're still waiting to hear from California, which could maybe change the outlook, but I suspect it's not going to change it that much. You know, the remember, I think last time we were talking, the percentage of people who vote early is massive. And I suspect in California, it's probably between 30% and 40%. And if they're doing it, if you can reel yourself back a couple of weeks before Vermont, before New Hampshire and Iowa, the reality is the guy who had momentum at that point was Biden. Mm-hmm. So, among the early voters. So I would not be surprised if a substantial portion of the early voters in California were Biden or one of the more centrist candidates at the time. The problem with elections now is that you really can't put them in a straight time frame. You sort of have to figure out at what point the voter, what does the voter know at the point at which he or she is making the decision? And early voters make it over the course of sometimes as much as, if I recall, 30 days in some cases. So it's very hard to tell. So if somebody voted just 2 weeks before Super Tuesday in any of those states, they would not have known that who won Iowa or who won New Hampshire.
Right.
So, and at that point, Joe Biden had the momentum.
Yeah, because he seemed like he's the one. Name ID matters a lot in politics, and people don't totally get that. And so
it's the single most important factor in how someone votes.
I totally agree. They have a familiarity with that person. Joe Biden was the vice president. He's been in politics forever. He's not an unlikable person. I mean, I think Joe Biden's likable. And then you have Bernie Sanders, who had the organization advantage because he still had all that organization from 2016 and nobody else did. Obviously, Bloomberg built up, and we'll talk about Mini Mike here in a moment.
Yeah, right. But also I think Biden represents a return to normalcy. Now, who campaigned on that? Do you recall?
It was it Coolidge?
Nope.
No, it was after...
Warren G. Harding.
Right. Harding was the return to normalcy?
Yes. And okay. He followed whom?
So was Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, that's right. Correct.
Yeah. And so, then Harding turned out to be super corrupt.
Well, and he died anyway, so it didn't much matter. And Coolidge, of course, was Silent Cal, Cool Cal.
So here's my question. Is it that everybody started paying attention around Iowa and got to look at all the other candidates and went, we're just going to go with the guy that seems the most safe?
I think in South Carolina, it was simple demographics. And I think, and if you look across at most of the states voting that he won, again, it is largely an alignment with Democrat demographics, which are largely African-American. Is one of the highest percentages. And so, I think that's a group that's been very loyal, and he got a tremendous percentage of that group everywhere in each of those primaries. Bernie also did not apparently, you know, he was appealing to the youth vote. A lot of the youth he appealed to 8 years ago are not so youthful anymore.
They're paying taxes now, Rob.
That's right. And they're probably voting, but he's trying to appeal to the younger voters. And once again, the young voters did not turn out in the primaries. And I think there's a lesson there for the general too. You know, no matter what we do, young voters have lots of other reasons and impediments to voting. They may live at school and not want to vote there or not be registered there. They maybe just don't think it's worth their time. They're too busy, you know. They don't feel motivated. They have no self-interest. So I think that's the big disappointment for Sanders.
Yeah, it seems like Biden won so big in South Carolina that everybody was kind of waiting to see, can this guy actually pull it out? And then they went with the winner. All of a sudden, all the endorsements started coming out of the woodwork.
Well, that was a good week for him. Yes, yeah. There's no question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of Democrats are genuinely scared to death of Bernie. Although I did see an interesting article. I think it was either the Post or the Times today or yesterday that compared Bernie to Reagan. And
yeah.
I thought that was a very interesting one, in which he essentially, you know, Reagan ran in 64. I'm sorry, in 60, he really kind of semi-challenged Nixon.
Was
64
Goldwater. Right.
And then he semi-challenged Nixon in 68 and didn't do very well. And then in 72, the campaign I was in, of course, he ran a serious challenge against Ford, as we've discussed in the last one, and really lost the nomination by basically one vote. And then he went on, after Ford lost, to become the nominee and president 4 years later. And so he at the time was viewed as an intellectual lightweight, kind of shrill, demagogic, you know, off to the far right, a cowboy. You know, I remember my own reactions at the time, and I certainly would have been considered more of an establishment centrist, center right Republican. He scared all of us to death, and yet he went on to become the face of the party. He remade the party, and I think Trump is doing the same thing to the Republican Party, although much more destructively. Reagan had a better sense of how to govern. He had already governed the third largest country on the planet, that being California, and the third or fourth largest budget on the planet, and so on and so forth. So he had real governing experience and a sense of what you could do and not do, and the power of the word. But Bernie is not dissimilar in terms of his potential, according, you know, thinking about this article, to remake the Democratic Party. He may well lose again, or he may, if he wins, he could be Reagan from the left, remake the politics of the party, the ideology of the party. And I would not count him out in terms of his ability to out debate Donald Trump, because he has a lot more conviction. And he could rouse enough people against Trump. So I'm not someone who automatically says he can't win, but I do think the Democrats are scared to death of him. And that's really what happened. And I think they're also nervous about Biden. You know, Biden has taken some time to warm up on the stump, and that's kind of problematic. He's got to figure out a way to both out nice out, and at the same time, kind of out shout Trump, but not in the same nasty way Trump does it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Biden gave a great speech on Super Tuesday night.
He did.
It's clear that his speechwriters, he hired Pete's speechwriters to rewrite his speech.
Right. That's right.
And he hit a lot of notes that I think will speak to a lot of independents, in that we're going to return to normalcy, we're going to return to a time, and this is his best pitch. Remember how good you had it under Obama? Like, everybody was miserable under Obama and hated Obama, but now under Trump, we're also miserable because, A, the media makes us feel that way, and then, B, some of us are genuinely miserable. And so he had a very good appeal. He had a very good speech. And here's my only concern with Biden beating Trump. It's that the "this is not who we are" line has never worked against Donald Trump. It didn't work for the 16 Republicans. It didn't work for Hillary Clinton. It hasn't worked for the media. It hasn't worked for Nancy Pelosi and the impeachment. Like, the people genuinely go, yeah, no, this is who we are. We're all Trump.
And I think if you think about the context of the environment into which he's running, so there's no question that the Democrats did Donald Trump a favor with impeachment, because they basically allowed his people to beat the crap out of Biden's son. And that Joe Biden's son is going to be the email issue of the 2020 election campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Republicans are trying to raise it in hearings in the Senate, which they can, although it was interesting, Romney sort of flirted with opposing that And then he was assured by the chairman that that it would not be partisan. Well, I'm sure we all believe that.
Right.
And you know, as unseemly as that deal was with Biden's son and all that, and it's very hard to believe he didn't know it since he had to file ethics forms like the rest of us. Nevertheless, that's going to be the issue. And that is going to be the main impact of the impeachment hearings, is to have given Donald Trump another big issue against the likely candidate, Joe Biden.
I also feel that it gives him an appearance of Teflon, an appearance of they came at me, I won.
Completely.
Yeah, you can't, if he screws up again, what are you going to do? Try impeachment again? Which they flirted at with the Roger Stone stuff. They were like, should we try it again? It's like,
well, but Nancy Pelosi, I think we all know that Nancy Pelosi put the kibosh on all of that.
Yeah.
Understanding exactly what it's, you know, what it would be doing. But kind of trying to remember where I was going on that whole line about that.
Hunter Biden is his biggest vulnerability is Hunter.
Yeah, the biggest vulnerability is Hunter. And Trump, I think Trump's big vulnerability may well be the coronavirus and or COVID-19, as it's properly called. And this, in some ways, this could be the revenge of the deep state. You know, if we walk over there for a minute, you know, early January, I think it was around the 3rd, they first got word at CDC that something was going on in China. And then it took a week or 2 weeks before they knew enough about it to be able to have any point of view. And then, and China, of course, is totally opaque. I think they didn't let any other countries in to look at it for almost a month and a half. And they, you know, they basically silenced everyone who made it public aware of it, and the one young doctor died who kind of broke out of that. And then and you realize January 3rd is only about 9 weeks ago.
Yeah.
That's when we learned about this new coronavirus. And I think objectively the deep state did their job. Although you know, there's another article in the Post today about how all that went and who told whom what, but one of the big kind of holdback in all of that is that, you know, the test itself has to be made essentially by the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, whereas in Europe and everywhere else, the test is made commercially, and I suspect they'll go to that. And I have no doubt the reasons are for reasons of certification and so on and so forth. But
yeah, so I saw a Twitter thread where basically this woman thought she had respiratory issues. She thought she had it, so she called like 5 or 10 agencies and doctors and hospitals and the CDC and or the State Board of Health, and nobody had any access to it and couldn't find it, and nobody knew where to get it, and everybody was ill-informed, and it was sort of like, it's your natural bureaucracy at work, right? If a bureaucratic institution is in charge of something, it's not going to function correctly. And since then, I have a friend who works at a school. Their school this week was contacted by 6 different agencies, preparing them to close them down for a week. And I suspect that, you know, by what you mean by deep state, it's that we're just now getting to a place where tests are available and they're not $10,000, and it wasn't mobilized early on. And secondly, it took the specter of getting a chunk of that $6 billion for local agencies to actually start working on this.
Well, yes, but I'm sort of, there's a balance here, because I actually think the so-called deep state actually kind of did its job in a responsible way.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Is my point, but
not that they were thwarting Trump, but that they were actually moving as they're supposed to.
They were moving as they were supposed to, which is to figure out what was going on. It took some time for them to clone the gene and to determine what the characteristics of it were. You have to do that before you can figure out a vaccine. Of course, a vaccine can't do anything about the fact that it's once you have it, you know, once you have it, you can't do anything about it. So the vaccine is to prevent it. The Chinese in the last couple of days have released a very detailed a set of procedures and practices and things that they tried in the early part of the period of all of this. But again, this is where this, so I sort of think this is one where, again, the media is helping to is helping Trump, because every commentator, I cannot go on the TV, and you know, I watch a wide range of TV down here since we don't get newspapers on an island.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm safe. You're a long ways away from me.
I don't know.
Right.
Internet these days. So.
Yeah, I know. Touch.
They're helping Trump is what you're saying.
But there's nothing you can't, you know, the day he stood up there with all of the doctors and experts and everything else, and they had a clear story, and you know, he mumbled around his thing. There were people, all of the commentators were saying, well, what's the story? Why is it so confusing? When are they going to get their act together? Why can't they deliver 1.5 million doses today? And the consequence is you see this woman, a Trump supporter, 10 days, you know, a week later saying, well, I don't think it's real.
Right.
And that's because the media drumbeat is just like every other issue. They cannot give him credit for doing anything. There's no question that he is an idiot. There is no question that he is not an expert. By the same token, there is no question that the thing he should be doing is reassuring people that it's not, that you can walk outside of your house in most places and not have to worry about it. And there are some simple common sense things you can do. So, you know, it's a real balance. I feel sorry for any leader, whether it's, you know, governor of New York or the mayor of Washington or wherever, trying to balance this whole issue of calm down, you know, calm down, have a drink.
And I actually think that he had a fairly good week as he was discussing it, because if you go back and watch his press conference or the Fox News town hall, or you see Mike Pence last week on the Sunday shows, like they were very calm. They were like, listen, we don't know. They were telling the truth. And the reality is the media for clicks wants to hype this up to a point that it's that Costco shelves are being overrun. People are in full body plastic suits on airplanes. Like they have scared people half to death. And because Donald Trump isn't freaking out in the way that they want him to freak out over this nonsense, like, wash your hands, you're going to be fine. Like, it's like the West Nile virus, but they're pretending it's the bubonic plague.
And well, it's nearly so bad as the West Nile virus in terms of transmission.
Exactly.
We couldn't control the little mosquitoes running around.
Yeah, the reality is in the Wuhan province, they had a potluck dinner with 40,000 families, and that lit the thing on fire. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, they had the crisis. It's like Donald Trump was very presidential in the way that he handled a lot of this. But the headlines out of it were Donald Trump disagrees with experts and scientists. And isn't he a buffoon? And it just makes people.
Of course, one of his problems is he has no credibility with anyone beyond his base. So, but remember that he had a 49 to 50% favorability immediately after impeachment. So, people should be careful about what they think is going on there. But to your point about the shelves, my son is, I think I've mentioned, is a chef in Sydney, Australia. And he sent us pictures last week of everything stripped from the shelves, particularly toilet paper. And of course I said to him, I hope he had gone down and taken some himself, what's interesting in this little tiny county of Matthews, where we have 8,000 people living on the shore of the lower shore of the Chesapeake Bay, everything's fine in grocery stores. Plenty of cold meds, you know, everything you need, toilet paper, whatever.
Yeah,
so, a group of people that may not believe it's a real issue.
Right. So here in Indiana, in Indianapolis, we got our first case, a Marion County resident, which is Indianapolis. And a friend posted a picture of a local Target where it was the entire aisle where they had Lysol wipes and hand sanitizer and toilet paper. Right. The entire thing was emptied. And what I always try to say to people is, like, listen, it's not that you are going to get quarantined for 2 weeks. It's that every other boob out there in the world thinks that they're going to be quarantined for 2 weeks. And so you always need to make sure that you stockpile some basics, because you may not be able to get access, because at our core, we're still like the same animal we were 10,000 years ago, where we hear of a plague. Like, the smartest people I know are freaking out. The smartest people in our society and the media are freaking out about this thing. And you're like, how bad could this get? And they're like, oh, well, if you're elderly and you have respiratory issues, you probably are going to die.
Yeah.
Okay, well, then why am I freaking out?
Well, there is this, you know, this question of belief. I have a very good friend in the tech community who I've known for years. He's somewhat older than I am, very well educated. And we had an email exchange yesterday about a company that had shut down, and he had observed, well, I don't know why everybody's so freaked out about it. It's just a cold, right? Like the flu. And I sent back a note saying, you know, it's 20 to 30 times more deadly than the flu. Number one. And number two, if you're over 65, it's 5 to 10 times more than that. And if you're under 65, it's 1/5 to 1/10 as much as that. So very concentrated. So yeah, it's real. And, you know, he didn't believe it, still doesn't believe it, I suspect. So, but I do think, but Trump, of course, does stuff all the time. It reminds us of who he really is. So, you know, at that CDC meeting the other day, he was quoted, he said, he was asked about whether or not to let the cruise ship on shore. And he said, I don't want to do it. Others do. We'll let them make the decision, but, you know, it'll double my numbers. You know, it was literally double my numbers. And by that, he means the numbers of people that are sick on his watch. And he thinks of it purely in personal terms, and I suspect he does.
And wasn't that what the New York Times was basically saying this weekend, that he didn't want to put out certain information because he didn't want to get blamed for the coronavirus, which the New York Times, Michelle Goldberg, writes this article, if you're feeling sick, it's because of Donald Trump.
Like, yeah.
You know,
Now the other side of that. So, you know, the big question is, does he believe it? So is he going to get himself tested this week from having gone to the conservative?
Oh yeah. CPAC.
CPAC. So that was just last week in Maryland, and thousands and thousands of people. One of the people with whom he came into indirect contact via only one person in separation has been diagnosed, and most of his cabinet came into direct contact with that individual and have now come in contact with Trump at some level or another. So the question is, are they going to take the test? And by the way, this is one I want to cycle back just one more second before we get off of this about the bureaucracy and the disinformation coming out of the news. I mean, the reality is, first of all, you really do have to concentrate your tests on people who you think are likely to have been exposed. And that is clearly what CDC did. They got test kits to everybody in the early stages who could conceivably have been exposed. And you realize that was no more than about 4.5 weeks ago, only 3.5 weeks after it'd been seeping out of China. And so they're increasing that. And so, you know, this morning, last night or the day before, Pence said, we've gotten however many 100,000 out, 300,000 out, and we'll have another million by the end of the weekend. And all they're doing is showing pictures of the target was 1.5 million. Well, I'm sorry. They had a bad batch, by the way, so they had to dispose of that. They may well have made 1.5 million, but maybe some people think throwing out a bad batch is a good idea. So there's that. And frankly, there are not enough people who have the fear of it, the concern about it right now, to use up 1.3 million kits. Maybe by the end of this week or next, there will be that many people. But by then, they'll have produced another million or 2 million or whatever. So I personally, you know, and I have... doesn't make me an expert, but I have a degree in biology and environmental science. I follow science. I'm reasonably well read on this stuff. I don't have any concern about our having enough kits to test the people who need to be tested. Where you're going to see the discombobulation is people on the margins, you know, people who just want to be tested out of fear and really have there's no obvious exposure pathway to them. And then you have, of course, this massive ship with several thousand people on board, and they really need to test every single one of those, and they need to do it yesterday. And that to me is kind of a big screw up. But those are massive, massive logistics nightmares. You know, think about the crew of the 42 or so people that were tested. 20 some had the virus, and 19 were crew members. Now that sounds massive, but remember that ship probably had 1,000 crew for a couple thousand passengers. So we have to be careful about the numbers too.
Yeah. So
by the way, I have an issue for you.
Okay.
Daylight saving time.
Yes. So let me do this.
So is it?
I want to transition, and I have a great transition into Bloomberg.
Okay.
Because I think I want to talk Bloomberg, and then we'll talk daylight savings time after that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, good.
So I'm watching 60 Minutes, and Scott Pelley, I believe it was interviewing Mike Bloomberg last Sunday before Super Tuesday. And Mike Bloomberg pushed some stupid notion about coronavirus and calling it a hoax. And Scott Pelley fact-checked him and said the president didn't say it that. In fact, what he meant is that X, Y, and Z was a hoax, but he didn't believe it. And it was such a news story that Scott Pelley of CBS News fact-checked the president on the positive side against a Democrat. That it made the news. That's how in the bag these people are invested in. That when somebody actually stands up for the president and gives facts, it's news. But I was impressed with Michael Bloomberg's operation, because what he had done in his $500 billion was build an organization in the way that Trump has built an organization. And now he's handing that over to Biden. And he had built the organization that Biden never had. And now...
That's right.
But at the end of the day, Michael Bloomberg spent $500 million to be told by millions of people, no, we don't like you. I mean,
And Bloomberg was trolling for the same people that Biden was trolling for, and Klobuchar and Pete and all the rest. So, and it's a very highly financed. That was actually intended to be, semi-commercial, not for profit when it was the targeting piece of that operation. And it was intended, targeting piece, as how you get a movement going to be successful. So I think it's going to be enormously helpful to Biden, and it'll be interesting to see if Trump can counter it.
Andrew Yang said on Saturday night during the coverage that one of his former employees had gone to work for the Bloomberg operation. And they had in district, they could target almost every voter in the United States within every precinct that they could mobilize. I mean, he really built on the back of, you know, Bloomberg folks, the operation that Obama had. And, you know, when you have an operation like that, it's very hard to say, oh, Trump has this in the bag because Biden's an old fool. Like, no, when you've got that kind of data operation behind you, and Bloomberg, if he does continue to spend money and deploy that, it can make Biden really much more competitive in places that you didn't think he could be competitive. Then, data is really key, along with name ID. And so that could be huge.
The issue still in politics is, can you get people to the polls?
Right.
And so where a targeting operation like Bloomberg's or Obama's, or frankly, the last time Republicans and so on and so forth, shows its value is with the early voter. So if you can target the early voter, get a ballot in their hands, see that they actually file it, you will have, you'll have 90%+ probability, I would expect, of getting their vote in the right place.
Yeah.
And so that is the benefit. Then you have the separate issue of the field operation. And I think the Bloomberg intent was to create an organization that not only could tell you who was the right person to deal with and who you'd like to get on board and what issues they cared about and how to move them intellectually, but also intended to be a way to motivate people to go out and get them to the polls. I mean, I certainly knew my daughter's mother-in-law down in Texas was knocking on doors for Bloomberg. I was like, oh, who knew? But I assure you that every door she knocked on would have been the right door to knock on.
Right. And that's key. Yeah. Drive out. Yeah. Because that was Hillary's problem, is she didn't motivate or mobilize the people she needed to mobilize.
Yeah. And, you know, I do think that it's potentially true that this could overcome some of the Biden bland. But, you know, you and I have been talking about this for several weeks, that I actually, if not 6 or 8 weeks, but, you know, I continue to believe it. I think Biden is still likely to get the nomination, and I think he's likely to pick Amy Klobuchar. I think she would be a great kind of stabilizing, nice personality. And I would absolutely not be surprised if Nikki Haley takes Pence's place and he's sent off to, I don't know, not what's the equivalent of Ireland for Mick Mulvaney, for Michael Pence, you know, for Pence.
Special envoy to
Slovakia or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Lesbos. But,
maybe Ukraine.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good chance. And if I had to lay money on the day many years out, you know, with very high odds against it, you know, I think either Amy Klobuchar or Nikki Haley is likely to be the next president in 2024.
I could see him picking Elizabeth Warren. Biden picking Elizabeth Warren as a way to try and shore up the progressive wing.
I could see that too.
Yeah.
I think that would be a little bit of a mistake because I don't think the progressive wing turned out for him the way the media has described it, partly because remember the numbers are so small to move in Iowa and New Hampshire. You're talking about hundreds of people one way or the other, not hundreds of thousands. It's much easier. And number two, he really did not move them that much in, nor did, you know, between the two of them, they had 50%, I guess, close to it. But no, they didn't. That's right. Because Biden was 49.8% in South Carolina, if I recall. I think the progressive movement is partly an anti-everybody else movement. So,
yeah. One final note about the election, then we'll go on to daylight savings time. I cannot believe the press about Elizabeth Warren's exit has just been, they're beside themselves. And it's all, it's because she's a woman. Hillary Clinton came out and said, there's no doubt that it's because she's a woman that people didn't vote for her. And it's like, and I saw some, I'm friends with the editor of Bellerico. People didn't vote for Pete because he was gay. I believe that people didn't vote for Elizabeth Warren because they don't like an unlikable scold.
People would argue that the language of calling her a scold is itself sexist. How many men do you know who've been called scolds?
I call Bernie Sanders a scold all the time. He's a scold. He's a scold.
He is an angry old white man, and she came across as an angry old white woman, I guess. Maybe that's a better way to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although she kind of calmed down. No, but I do think there is an inherently some amount of sexism. I think there was another article I read a couple days ago about an interview in which a major magazine, and maybe it was a women's magazine or something, asked her, how did she get such a lovely complexion? And, you know, geez, when I ran, nobody asked me about mine. Although once I was described as having a swarthy complexion because I'd been in the sun and down running in Florida, and, you know, and a much darker wild hair and all that kind of stuff. And I enjoyed being called swarthy, but, and she replied Pond's, you know, night cream or something. But that is only a question a woman would get. I think there continues to be that. I don't think that's why she lost though. And I think there was an amazing lack of anti-gay in the vote against Buttigieg. I just think he's pretty young. But anyway, so by the way, you just made a mistake about time. What did you call it?
Daylight savings time.
It's singular.
I know, but I don't. I'm a Hoosier. That's what we say here. But listen, you have to understand that in Indiana, we're all brand new.
Hoosier with an S.
We're all brand new to this because we didn't start doing this until we elected Mitch, and then Mitch said, "All right, this is enough," and then forced it through. It was a 30-year argument here, and in 2008 or 9, we started doing daylight saving time, And you have no idea.
I'm convinced.
You have no idea what a nightmare it was here when we didn't do it, especially in the radio industry. Twice a year, all of our automation would get screwed up. Nobody ever knew where we were. And Daniels was exactly right. He was like, if everybody else is doing it, we need to do it too. It's costing us business. And it was.
And I'm convinced. There are lots of good reasons for it. And, you know, it was to save energy. And you can go through all these lists of save energy and make it safer for kids coming home and blah, blah, blah. But I am convinced, and I was again reminded as I got up this morning in the pitch black, the sun had been coming up as I get up at 5:45, you know.
Right.
And today it was pitch black for another hour. And I'm convinced that if Joe Biden came out and said, we're going to stop this silliness, we're going to do daylight savings time, or we're going to do, or we're going to do regular time, one or the other, but we're going to stop it or split the difference, even like the Russians, that person would win.
Yeah.
Because this is such a pain in the butt and everybody hates it.
And you get so tired and that, you know, I work in morning radio. And so this week's show.
And then you get used to it. And by the time you get used to it, boom, it's over.
You know, we're
I think it's actually I think we have more daylight saving time on the calendar than we do regular time.
Right. Yeah.
So you might as well stay at daylight saving time.
So I'll give the listeners a little bit of history about it just because I've been interested in this. So the time zones and time standardization came about with the invention of the railroads because the railroads would go town to town. And before the railroads really came into play in the mid-1800s, you'd go from Plainfield to Avon to Danville to Amo. And there would be a different – they set their clock tower based on when the sun was right overhead at noon. And so you have a few minutes off everywhere you went. And so they needed a standardized time to make the trains run on time. And then in World War One, they started daylight saving time to give people an extra hour of prep, and also for the agrarian society, more time to farm in the evening. And then now it's just basically like what you said, it's about saving energy. It supposedly gives us more, it gives us some sort of savings on lights and air conditioning. And so that it would be billions of dollars in energy cost if we changed it. And that's sort of why nobody touches it. But I agree. I think by and large, people think it's a real pain in the butt. It's stupid. You know, our next week at work, because everybody gets up at 2 or 3, everybody's going to be super cranky for the next week or two. And it's sort of annoying. And, you know, I agree with you. I think if somebody took a strong stand against it, it'd be popular.
And what do you want to bet that sometime in the next 48-hour cycle, Donald Trump is going to say, I hate this switch.
Oh, 100%.
Let's just leave it at daylight saving time.
Yep.
He's going to win another 5% of the vote.
Yep. Because that's the beauty of Donald Trump is he understands that it doesn't matter if he can get it done or not. Bernie Sanders is the same way. It doesn't matter if you can do it or not. It's what people care about.
Yeah. And I can imagine around Biden, his issue team is saying, oh, we can't do this because there's the pros and there's the cons. And what do you do when you don't switch back and blah, 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 blah. So I can see that really easily.
People love confidence.
Yeah, I agree.
Even if you're a confident idiot like Donald Trump.
Yes, even if you're a confident idiot. Yes. So, well, let's see. So we've done disease. We've done politics. We've done, whoops. Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me? Did I stop?
No, I just lost you.
Uh-oh.
Watched the picture, but that's just as well.
You don't have to look at me. No,
nor me. I guess you can see me. I just can't see you.
So we've got 20 minutes left. Let's talk about the Jones Act, because there's been some developments, and we've been meaning to talk about the Jones Act a little bit. And so why don't you catch us up on it and let us know where things are at? You've been speaking at the Cato Institute about it, I've noticed. And so first give like a elevator pitch of what the Jones Act is and then give us an update.
Yeah. So, so for those uninitiated, the Jones Act is a law that requires you to use American built, bought, manned, owned, operated ships if you're going to sail a ship between two points in the United States and drop off cargo, pick up and drop off. And there's a sister law called the Passenger Vessel Act which says you can only be one of these kinds of ships if you're going to pick up an American cruise passenger and cruise him from, let's say, New York to Miami. And it sort of sounds nice on the face of it. It's a 1920 law that was passed after World War One. We did not have enough ships. The law, the bigger law, was intended to help increase shipbuilding in the U.S., which had gone stagnant, and to rebuild the fleet. And immediately after the war, they basically had rebuilt the commercial fleet during the war for carrying supplies. And they basically turned that over to commercial industry. And that might well have been the highest point it ever was until World War II, when they had a similar problem. And then after that, the fleet has declined from some 60,000 ships, meaning they have a deep draft. They can sail out on the ocean. They're self-propelled, to something under 79 or 80 today, something like that. And the people who continue to support it claim that it benefits the military by allowing us to have a busy commercial fleet that in time of war can be thrown right in to help resupply the troops overseas, and which creates lots of jobs on board these ships for sailors who, you know, they have 8-hour turns. And so they're like three for every job. And the reality, unfortunately, is very different. The shipyards have no new orders today. The only orders they have are defense, very large, very expensive, very complex, and very largely poorly delivered ships, frankly, in a lot of ways. The number of jobs is, you need about 1,800 or 2,000 sailors to run the resupply during a major conflict. We don't even have 1,300 or 1,400 of them. And the average age of a guy in this, in a labor guy in the merchant marine now, is in the 50s, late 50s. Some of them are as old as in their late 90s, and they're considered active. So it's a pretty disastrous outcome. And the big economic thing it has done is it disadvantages Americans in shipping. So the cost of the ships built in the U.S. is 3 to 5 to 6 times higher than it is anywhere else in the planet. And they are no better, but they just cost more because we just don't build them, and we don't build well, and we don't build enough. And so you start with an investment disadvantage. And then beyond that, once someone buys one of these ships to stay inside the Jones Act trade, meaning from the continental U.S. to Hawaii or Alaska or Puerto Rico, or up and down the coast, once you buy it, you never get rid of it. So most ships are retired at 20 years old. Jones Act ships average close to 40 years old. Our tanker fleet is way past. All tankers are required by law to be Jones Act built in the U.S. This is one reason people go for pipelines, you know, so it's pushed stuff into pipelines. It's a mess. We don't have a shipbuilding industry. We don't have enough sailors. We have industries that have literally been put out of business in the U.S. The timber industry used to ship everything, a lot of it, to the U.S. And now there's no domestic timber industry except local, because they cannot ship at long distances because they can't get the right kind of ships. They used to ship cattle. They can't. Feedstocks, grain used to all go. Those all require specialized ships. They don't have them. And so this, however, is the third rail of special interest politics. You know, they always say Social Security is the third rail of American politics, but the Jones Act is the unknown, maybe fourth rail of politics. And everybody supports it because what they're told is, oh, it's critical to national defense. And why are they told that? Because the labor unions funnel them a lot of money, and the labor unions believe, against all facts to the contrary, that it keeps them in business, and it does not. It actually has destroyed them by making shipping so expensive that everything that used to go by ship now goes by trains or trucks. And in some cases by airplane. And so it's just, you know, I headed a group trying to get rid of this in the 90s. Um, and it's still there. But there are a number of interesting things. For the first time, a congressman from Hawaii actually opposes it and has come out with several pieces of legislation to modify it, particularly in their own context of Hawaii. They like to make themselves a special case, thinking that's going to help them. But this is Steve Case, who is the founder of AOL, or not the founder, but the CEO, took him public and all that. His brother, Ed Case, is a congressman and has enough money not to give a hoot what the unions want to do to him. And he is a Democrat, so that's very unusual. For years and years, the delegation in Hawaii was bought off by the unions. You know, Inouye and all these folks were pillars of the both the socialist state of Hawaii and the labor state of Hawaii and the Jones Act, notwithstanding that it added a couple thousand dollars to every one of their constituents' bills. But, you know, it's a good example of what in management we call reframing, Chris. You know, you can take an issue and we see it in politics all the time, which is here's one set of this is a view of a certain issue. And then this is the other view. And, you know, for anyone who's objective, it's destroyed the fleet. It's destroyed the sailors. It's just, you know, there's no benefit whatsoever. It's just a cost. He reframed it, and its supporters in Hawaii reframed it to be, this is what keeps us alive. Otherwise, we wouldn't have anything come from the mainland, all of which is untrue. So there are some things happening. And I, you know, there actually is going to be a debate, I think next week, which I'll let you make sure you can see have all your listeners see. It's on the Maritime TV. And that'll be interesting. There is there's sort of cracks here and there. I think Ed Case may have the best ability to do something about it. Cato, of course, is hammering away. But there are diehard supporters everywhere. So if I had to give all of this a chance, what percentage do I think we'll have it modified or gotten rid of in 5 years? I'd give it 5%, but that's 50 times greater than I would have given it 10 or 20 years ago.
So what is it about human beings that even though they're presented with evidence to the contrary, that they don't believe it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there's a lot written on that, you know, these days. And it's particularly true. I forgot this. There's a new book out on identity politics. And I think you and I, maybe in one of our shows, ought to go through some of these books for our listeners, because they're whole sets of books trying to analyze, some better than others. This particular author makes the point that we used to gather more around issues or things which we jointly supported. And you can create movements that way. But today it's more about who you identify with and support. So, and regardless of what the issue is. So that's why so many people can support a Trump or a Bernie Sanders, regardless of whether they agree with them on one major issue or another. It's because in their circles, they don't want to be the odd man out. And I don't know that people make that, but you know, people are herd animals, just like, you know, we are all animals, right? So the older I get, the more it's clear to me, human beings,
this is
just like the animals we are.
This is going to mean nothing to you, but to our listeners, it may mean something. There's the head of the party currently, who's not running for re-election. His name is Nick Sarwark. He's head of the Libertarian Party. And he got into a spat with a guy named Maj Toure, who was a former Libertarian candidate in Philly. Now he's a Republican MAGA guy. And he says, oh, I left because of Nick Sarwark and all these things. And basically these two people, and there's a group of podcasters who all basically just try to ding Nick Sarwark, or people on Nick's team try to ding the other team. And it's just basically they're trying to grow their audiences by picking on each other. And You're either with me or you're against me. And it's very effective, and it's completely that Donald Trump style of politics has completely changed the libertarian movement in the last 3 to 4 years. And I've seen it go from when I started in 2008, it was about ideas. It was not about personalities. People jokingly said the word celebritarian. And then all of a sudden now, all that matters is, are you supporting the right celebritarian or not? And You know, people like me, you got to pick a side. Are you with Dave Smith or are you with Nick Sarwark? And it's just a complete shift in the last decade of how the movement operates to its detriment, to the point that people like yourself are going, I see all this on Twitter. I don't want to get involved with these nuts.
Yeah. Although I'm in constant Twitter wars on the Jones Act of all things. And what a surprise, right? Yeah. I have a opponent who likes to throw out. He's a history professor at some little school somewhere in South Carolina or North Carolina. I can't remember which one. And there are people who are single-mindedly, they cannot process that there may be other information outside of, their fact range. And even if it is outside of the fact range that they're familiar with or care about, they have to figure out a way to fit it into their view of the universe, or in this case, in my view, the Bible. You know, I view the Jones Act as a religion, which explains a lot about its supporters, frankly. Religion is a belief system at its core. And you asked about facts. Facts, people will fit contrary facts into their view of the universe. And I sure see it in my Twitter wars.
All right.
And for those of you who want to follow these Twitter wars, it's Rob Cortell at Rob Cortell. So you can follow it.
And we always put that into the show notes, so you can grab it there. Add him on LinkedIn as well.
Yeah.
So we've come to the end where Rob is a, dare I say, a bon vivant, and likes to go out to...
I think a gourmand is what you were trying for.
And likes
my wife would get upset if you said I was a bon vivant.
Well, I barely know what that means, so I probably used it wrong. But you love to go out to eat, you love to go out and drink, you love to take tours of Washington, D.C. with your friends and make merry. And you always give us at the end of every show a good spot for people to go when they visit the nation's capital, as they should. It's a very fun place to visit. Everyone should go at least once in their life. And when they do, where should they eat or drink?
It's been about 2 weeks since we last got together, and I only had a couple days in D.C., but I went to a new restaurant called Albi, A-L-B-I. Also on the waterfront in Southeast. And it's the chef, Michael Raffitti, who has a terrific bona fides in the Washington food scene and around, has opened his first first restaurant that he's ever opened. And it's a Middle Eastern restaurant in a luxury building down there. His previous take was with sort of a Spanish paella restaurant, Arroz. This guy has Palestinian and Jordanian roots. But he basically, first of all, the restaurant's beautiful. Second of all, it's just terrific. It's kebabs and, I mean, the pita comes out of the oven hot, and it's in this beautiful, like a football, bigger than most, lots of different kinds of shareable plates, gorgeous wood-fired grill, so on and so forth. But it's called Albi. I think it's hard to get into, frankly. It's hard to make a reservation. When I talked to the host there the other night, he said they always keep a fairly high percentage for walk-in. So if you're down on the waterfront of D.C., on the southwest waterfront, the southeast waterfront, you should consider heading over there. And next door to it is a lovely bar, Maxwell's. Maxwell was, they have one other bar up on 10th Street, if I recall. And it's a wine bar that has, they have great sets of tasting trios and things like that. And the two owners kind of own, apparently, Raffitti has a small stake in Maxwell's and maybe vice versa. And Maxwell's did his wine and liquor list and all that. So it's a great combo. My wife and I had a terrific dinner down at Albi. Again, it's Mediterranean. It's very different than you will have had, and very, very creative. And afterwards, we had a nice drink at Maxwell's, which, by the way, had four women bartenders and none of them, you know, there were no men bartenders. So that was in itself a revelation, particularly as we were about to head into International Women's Week.
Excellent.
And there you have it.
All right. We'll make sure to check Albies.
Albies.
How do you spell it?
A-L-B-I. And then Maxwell's down on right next door to it on the southeast waterfront.
All right. Excellent. Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining me.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's great
fun.
Great to talk to you, and we'll talk to you soon.
More fun coming up.
Exactly right. All right. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Swamp Explained on We Are Libertarians, and we will see you very soon. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. And you can find more great shows like this at WeAreLibertarians.com. Shows like We Are Libertarians with Chris Spangle, The Brian Nichols Show, The Boss Hog of Liberty, Now Hear This with Chris Spangle, Gingerarchy with Tricia Stewart Mann, and our training podcast, Upward, Libertarian Activism. All of these shows are supported by our patrons. If you'd like to become a Patreon member, visit WeAreLibertarians.com. Thank you so much for listening to this show.